Welcome to the Circumference podcast series. I'm your host, Montana Ray, and today I have the privilege of speaking with Jennifer Hayashida. Jennifer, by way of an introduction, could you tell me a little bit about your family background and how you came to translate Swedish?
So I am born in California. I'm born in Oakland. My mom's Swedish. My dad was Japanese American. And when I was five, my mom and I moved back to Sweden. She came to the U.S. in the mid-60s as an au pair, so she was a first-generation immigrant, whereas my father was third generation, so I never learned Japanese, but I did learn Swedish. My mother always spoke Swedish to me growing up, and eventually I started speaking Swedish as well. So I grew up in Sweden, was educated there basically from first grade until 11th grade when we moved back to the States. We would spend summers in California, but the academic year in Sweden. So I was bilingual and didn't really think much of that except that it was useful when I was in Sweden, even if all Swedes speak English. And then when I was in grad school, actually at Bard, I was in my second year, so my second summer there, and I was totally stuck. I had a meeting with David Levi Strauss. And we were talking about my bilingualism, and he was talking about not being bilingual. And he said, you know, you should really explore what that means. And so I started translating Fredrik Nyberg, whose book I had picked up in Sweden the previous summer. And I just loved it in Swedish. It never occurred to me that I would translate it. But that was like my exercise for that summer, was to remain constant in the translation, even when my own writing was pretty much all over the place and felt like it was falling apart. I had this other practice that actually felt like it was coming together. So it was a source of tremendous comfort for me to have translation as this steady, sort of coherent thing when my writing was becoming less and less familiar to me. So.
Or that it's already formed, you know,
it
you
is.
Have something that has a clear end.
Exactly.
As well.
And the burden, I've said this before, the burden of originality was not on me. I didn't have to have the ideas. I just had to solve problems. And that was, you know, in some ways, I think it would probably be good for me if I thought of writing as problem solving, just more generally.
Yeah.
And not just in terms of translation, but so.
Jennifer, we're mainly going to be discussing your translation practice and your current translation projects, but I wanted to mention how multifaceted you are. As an artist, you do have a visual background, you work with projections and video, and you also are director of Asian American Studies at Hunter. Do you think you could speak to what it means to be so multifaceted?
I think, I keep using the word comfort, but one of the ways that I think about the disparate practices I have is that I always grew up feeling like I was in between. Like I was always sort of dislocated and just from traveling back and forth and existing between languages, you know, racially existing between my parents and you want, on the one hand, feeling very Swedish when I was in the U.S., but looking Japanese-American, and then in Sweden, feeling very racially other, but still performing a kind of Swedishness. So I've been able to sort of inhabit that in-betweenness by not solely inhabiting one practice. In a way, so I guess that's the carved-out space, is the non-space. Which, you know, you could call it like a transnational space or an interstitial space or whatever, but I feel like that has been the consolation of realizing that not having a space is a space.
Right.
That sounds really hokey, but, and I think my so-called training in terms of graduate school is also a part of that, where, you know, BART is an interdisciplinary program, and even though you're working in your own discipline, you understand the parallel processes within each discipline. So, you know, I identified very closely with the painters and the photographers because our processes of arriving at the print or the drawing or the painting were very similar, and there was something very liberating about that that allowed me to think of writing poetry as a painting practice. Mm-hmm. And again, that was a relief because I felt like, well, the burden of poetry, which I think I've always experienced as a kind of burden, was sort of lifted in a way if I allowed myself to think of it as taking a photograph.
I found it very interesting what you were saying about using a multifaceted approach to understanding interstitial identity and personhood. And I wondered if you would talk about the essay No More Strike Anywhere as an extension of those practices toward the understanding of a complex idea of statehood.
That essay is that essay is sort of a drawing in a way, mm-hmm, for a video that I ended up making with Benj, my partner, who's a filmmaker. And the problem with discussing that essay is that I can't readily identify which part I wrote and which part he wrote at this point. So it's sort of like exquisite corpse. I have no way of really knowing, of mapping, like, which part is mine and which part is his, which is what made it such a great experience, but also what makes it sort of challenging to look back on. The project itself came out of a sort of ongoing concern that I have, which now feeds into my translation work, but at the time, I don't think I made that connection as clearly, but an ongoing concern that I have regarding global perceptions of Sweden, mm-hmm, and misconceptions, really, and, you know, these sort of elided histories of colonialism and certainly this sort of prehistory of neoliberalism that fascinates me, given the current sort of erosion of the welfare state and pervasive excitement around neoliberalism in Sweden. In spite of histories that tell us otherwise, they're completely dismantling everything. Mm. And people are genuinely excited about it because they don't know what privatized healthcare looks like. So in any event, the essay was a way to try to map some of those ideas, and eventually those ideas worked their way into a video and a film that we made. But the origins of the project do have to do with this idea that, you know, the welfare state is a fiction, mm-hmm, and it has always been a fiction in many ways, but the way it's being dismantled highlights both its fictive qualities and the urgency of maintaining, yeah, it at the same time. So it's a contradictory.
So, interesting. So you've published with Litmus Press and with Ugly Duckling Press. Are you particularly interested in correcting misconceptions of Swedish literature within your own community of writers?
Sorry, I'm laughing because I feel so removed from any community right now since I have a child and I don't go to poetry readings, and it's sort of a standing joke that I don't go to poetry readings and I don't really see people.
except your child, which is important.
Except my child and you. But the projects that I've translated are all ones that I have arrived at on my own. I didn't understand or think that they would be published, mm, until long after I had finished them. Inner China was sort of a labor of love. And then I showed it to Tracy, whom I didn't even really know. It was all sort of mediated through a friend, this lovely, lovely guy named Max. He brought it to Tracy and she loved it. Mm. It was, I think in many ways, she felt the same way about the text that I did. And Frederick's book, also, I don't remember how Anna saw it. I honestly don't remember. Because, mm-hmm, when I choose them, it's just, or when I start translating them, it's really just because I want to see what they look and sound like in English. More recently, and I was realizing this when I was looking at Inner China in a different practice, I translate very differently now, where the first two books probably in total took 2 or 3 years to translate because I was a much slower translator, and now, I've just finished working on a much longer text, which was conceptually and theoretically much denser, but I've become a faster translator, and I think that has changed my relationship to the texts. So I have a tremendous amount of love for these first two books, and I love these other ones too. But I see how there's been a shift in my practice. Okay. All this is to say I've just been very lucky. You know, these other two books are going to come out this winter and next year as well on Black Square. And I've just been incredibly fortunate that there are editors and small presses who are willing to put these books out there. Because they, to me at least, and maybe I'm overestimating their import, but to me, they defy or challenge a lot of the notions of what a Swedish book of poetry is going to look or sound like, or what themes it's going to address. And not that everything's rooted in, you know, the national origins of the book, but I feel like the more the text troubles those assumptions, the happier I am.
I think that's a great segue into reading some of your translations, if you don't mind, Jennifer. Maybe you could start with Yeva Houdin's Inner China.
So, the book is essentially one long poem, and I'll be reading from the first third. So the we is two sisters. We huddle in the couch. Elo's spring catalog has arrived. Edith insists. Wants me to turn the pages. Who is the prettiest, I am supposed to say. Who is the prettiest, I say. On each page, she presses her finger hard on the blonde one, holds her dirty finger on her smile. Saliva runs out and wets the pages. We tear out the blonde one in a bikini. In the shed, cobwebs give way to our faces. Dust drags in disgust, devotion on our lips. So we place the blonde with the dead. And I say a prayer, thin and limp in the dusty darkness. If we sink into the couch, it just gives way, down to the springs even deeper, like the bottom of the creek just sinks and sinks beneath your feet. There is no end. So I urge Edith. We have things to do. We silly our way down to the main road. Silently we walk in the long gaps between cars, search for wounded, dead. Finally, a dark spot on the road, a run-over bird with a broken neck. I whistle to Edith, quickly pull the plastic bag out of my jacket, put on the old gloves that smell of dog. We come walking with a sticky dead bird in a plastic bag. He is standing in front of the house, him. What you got there? None of your damn business, I say. By the way, it's a dead bird. Do you want to see? I extend the bag towards him. He pulls back. You go to mother. She is lying there ready and waiting, you son of a bitch. It is quiet. His face completely white. And I only hear Edith's phlegmy breathing, the plastic bag rustling softly in the hushed wind.
That was Jennifer Hayashida reading Yeva Houdin's Inner China. Jennifer, it struck me as I was listening to your translations, that book not only subverts an idea of Sweden as the welfare state, but also an idealization of the mother.
Now, there's no idealized figure in the book, really, which is what makes it so grim in a lot of ways. Like, there's no consolation. The consolation is the relationship between the sisters. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, even that relationship is broken down. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also an interesting parallelism for me in terms of the relationship between the sort of failed state and the failed mother, and the fact that the sisters have to sort of care for themselves in a lot of ways, and the ways in which they sort of scavenge, essentially.
Would you mind reading the poem about when the social services come?
No, okay? No, I don't mind at all. I might start crying. That's the one thing.
Well, I also think in terms of the, you know, the welfare state or just the insertion of the state in the family. It's an interesting dimension.
Okay, if I cry, I cry. One day, they just picked her up. Social services searched with its bright light, shone into dark sockets, along muddy slopes, sliding slowly into the creek. The unnecessary places scattered along the E4. They found Edith in the couch, sucking on her teddy bear, mother in a stupor, the dog, stinking from a tumor that had grown in its gums. Dried, stiff, he lies on the linoleum and dies. I was not there. Mother told me this, that they had taken her away, that... Shut up, I screamed. Couldn't stand to hear anymore. Then I took the dog in my arms and carried him 3 kilometers to the village. Rings had expanded around the iris. Yellow thin rings, as though he was now found as well. A dying dog is remarkably light and heavy. Kind, grateful, he licked the back of my hand with his diseased tongue. His mouth stank. I didn't mind at all. Down in the village, they found a veterinarian just like that. We sat in a warehouse behind Konsum. His bag was very fat, shiny. There, there, old friend, he said. That doesn't look good. Now your mama has to be good, or do you want to go out? I shook my head. He raised the syringe. The dog went limp, died with its heavy head in my lap. We sat like that for a while. Me, the veterinarian, the dead dog in an embrace.
I'm telling you, I could never have translated this book once I had a child. There's no way.
Right. Well, as you said, the Grimm quality, I was thinking about the Brothers Grimm and how those books are ostensibly for children, but are actually this warning to parents that the world is such a scary and dark place, and you parents better think twice before bringing a child into this scary environment.
Well, it's funny because in Sweden, there's this Astrid Lindgren, the Swedish children's book author who wrote the... She's most famous here for the Pippi Longstocking books, but all of her stories, in one way or another, have to do with self-sufficiency and children having to sort of deal. Yeah. And, you know, they're written during post-war period, and they reflect certain changes in Swedish society, and, you know, she's huge. Like, she has stamps. Like postage stamps, and she's a national hero. But what's interesting is that you read these books, and they're so grim in some ways because they're all about children having to take on adult responsibilities. Mm. And it's presented as though they're stories for children. Mm. But in reality, I feel like a lot of them are not. You know, there's this book, The Brothers Lionheart, which is a book that she wrote, which is all about, you know, this older brother telling the younger brother a story as the younger brother is essentially dying. Mm. And it's incredibly sad. But somehow the sadness of it is not really, I don't know, it's a weird aspect of Swedish.
Well, in Inner China, that, like, so much of it takes place in the forest, and mm-hmm. there is this kind of, like, childhood experience of...
Yeah, but it's like a late capital playing, yeah. where they're just on their own.
Yeah.
This is the thing to me where, you know, the book largely, as an imagined place at least, is in the northern part of Sweden. That's where Eva is mm-hmm. from, and it is a rural sort of post-industrial society, and it's one of the poor, not the poorest region in Sweden. Like, they're setting up server farms there now because there's all this space. Anyway, that's a whole other project. But one of my hopes is that, you know, these can exist intertextually mm-hmm. with other books, you know, about similar topics. But without the translation, they won't have that opportunity. And I think the desire to see texts butt up against each other is really important to me, and I think that it's a disservice to Swedish literature to just keep translating the same damn books
by
the same authors who have similar preoccupations, to try to translate texts that deviate from some of those preoccupations is very important, because that allows them to exist in relation or in dialogue with texts that present similar challenges.
And I just, also the insertion, like even within this book itself, when the kids find the book, where, I don't, what is the story where they take on the roles of those two?
Of the two Chinese kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that story, I don't even know if it's a fiction or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it's like a fiction within the fiction, or if it actually exists. But they're already in like this intertextual dialogue even within the book.
Right.
You know, it's interesting because like China in the book is this remote, unknown other, but they're already in their sort of remote, unknown other, even domestically. So it's an interesting sort of metaphor.
And they take comfort in that injection of a new narrative in
that,
you know, and that it's become something that they can actually live out because what's going on is so unlivable, or the horror of whatever the story is itself relates, you know, it's, you know, as you were saying that, like, the need for both, like, stories to bump up against each other for a writer, but also in our lives to kind of have that bumping up with other people's experiences. So you're like, okay, this sucks, but I'm not the only one,
No,
like, out there.
No, and the consolation that they find in that narrative is really interesting. And I think also, as someone who does think about representations of Asia all the time, I appreciate the fact that in the book, China is not other. That it, I mean, it is in the sense that everything outside of what they know is unknown already, but it's not orientalized and it's not exoticized. And in fact, they're the ones in the extreme situation, not the Chinese kids. And I think that's an interesting inversion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the interest of time, we should move along to Fredrik Nybitty. Would you read an excerpt or a few of the poems from A Different Practice?
So I'm going to read two poems from the middle section of the book. Summer months. Yes, I am familiar with the seasons. I know that people die also during those three summer months. June, July, August, in these small, small rooms with Wimbledon tennis on the tube. Death is not a problem of formulation when it comes up close. That is why one can stand in a kitchen and rinse lettuce while saying, "It went well, but it was too big." You are dead, and so not with me now. I neither can nor should pronounce all that which will still always return, and then return in the form of fragments from other people's lives, or in the memory of certain determined places, and so on. I was never close to this death. I was close to the one whom this death continued through. Children who sleep. These days, dreary as brick, death is a conflict also in the poem. All thoughts that with necessity must nullify themselves. I think then, for example, of those thoughts a mother has the moment before she at night leans over her soon 1-year-old sleeping son to hear if he is still breathing, and he is still breathing.
That was Jennifer Hayashida reading the poems of Fredrik Nybitty from A Different Practice. Jennifer, you mentioned that he was one of the first poets you translated at Bard. So as a formative translator-poet relationship, how was working with Fredrik Nybitty?
So far, and I think this will always be the case, I only work with living poets because I want to have some kind of dialogue. You know, I contacted Fredrik, and I don't know how it is in the States, but in Sweden, at least, when it comes to poetry, the rights always remain with the poet. And he was more than willing to have me translate the work. But he himself said that his grasp of English was such or is such that he didn't really feel like he had that much to contribute, except if there were particular questions I had about his word choices. And so, you know, we did all of the work on this book via email.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had questions sometimes about, you know, like I said, word choices and word order and certain ideas and internal references within the book. But he was pretty hands-off, very supportive, but
mm-hmm.
hands-off. And eventually, once the book came out, we got funding from the Swedish Arts Council, and he came to the States, and we did a few readings with Johannes Göransson, who's lovely. And it was great to have Fredrik here, and it was great, like I said, to hear him read the poems, because they sound very different in Swedish rhythmically. I've translated the book that he published after this. He's prolific. I think he's on book number 7. So, you know, granted that's 15 years, but essentially he publishes a book every other year, sometimes every year. And he also completed a PhD program in creative writing in Gothenburg, and Norstedts, his publisher, also published his dissertation, which is all about sound and poetry, which I don't think I can translate. So I'm still trying to find a publisher for that second book, which I also really love. And we just have this ongoing relationship. You know, if he publishes something, he'll just send it to me. Not because he wants me to translate everything, but I think because he just wants to remain in dialogue. And if work ever comes up where he's doing something that he thinks needs translation, I just do it for him. And we have, to me, an extremely comfortable and generous and respectful relationship, and it's really ideal.
That's wonderful.
It is.
That's
I feel very lucky, and
it's
sort of the standard I aspire to with
mm-hmm.
the authors I work with.
And in what ways do you feel like a different practice disrupts a notion of Swedishness or Swedish literature?
Well, this one's harder. To me, this book is not as rooted in any particular identity formation or subjectivity.
It's so universal.
It is.
Yeah.
And it is so Swedish. It's so traditionally Swedish in a lot of ways. And this comes up in subsequent books of his. There's a lot of natural landscape.
Summer houses.
There's a lot of flora and fauna. And, you know, the book that Clockwork of Flowers, which is the book that I translated after this. You know, it's based on Linnaeus and the taxonomy of flowers
mm-hmm.
or plants
mm-hmm.
that he came up with, and a preoccupation with plant life and landscape and tradition. I don't know how to describe it except to say that I feel like Fredrik has a very light touch, but it's there. You know, like he has a poem about crayfish, which
mm-hmm.
are, like, right now we're in the month of crayfish parties in Sweden,
mm.
and it's a very Swedish thing. The heather, the small lakes, the mosquitoes,
mm-hmm.
the light of the poems is very Swedish. And, you know, in that sense, this book does not trouble any of those things. But I guess to me, and this is where I just go into sort of appreciation mode, I feel like the humanity of the book and this light touch and the sort of peripheral, everything sort of in the periphery in the book and what you see in the out of the corner of your eye, and I feel like that is what makes the book so amazing and startling. And the concern, you know, the concerns around mortality. And he and I talked about this, but it's also somewhere, I can't remember, I think it's in Clockwork of Flowers, where he quotes someone, and I think Fredrik has said this on a number of occasions, where writing poetry is a way of creating a kind of order.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was his first book, and this book took him longer to write than any of his other books. I can't remember how long he said, but it was multiple years. And he feels, at least that is what he told me a long time ago, is that he felt like it was a very foreign object to him at this point. But I think the fact that it is very much a first book,
mm-hmm.
I think that's something that I like about it as well, that it's clearly someone trying to look at similar questions from multiple vantage points.
Given the universal quality to the voice in A Different Practice, albeit with specific Swedish content, I wonder what you were thinking about gender, or if you were able to set gender aside while you were translating these poems.
No, I mean, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the class, race, gender part can't be set aside. You know, I don't want to conflate the book with the author. I don't want to say that he's the person speaking in this book, but I think it's just better to be upfront and say, you know, this is a book written by a white male Swede, and it's a book written by a white male Swede, and I think it's an amazing book, and
mm-hmm.
I'm very proud of the translation. At the same time, it contradicts a lot of my sort of positions as a translator that have evolved since then. Would I still translate this book? Yes, because
mm-hmm.
I think it's an incredible book. I think that he does a lot of things in the book that don't necessarily challenge assumptions around, you know, a sort of male gaze or a male authorial voice, but I do think that the way it inhabits the primarily domestic space,
mm-hmm.
I think the fact that it doesn't, and this is a tremendous generalization around like any sort of male narrative, because they're not all heroic, but there's nothing to me, well, there are a few moments in the book that feel very male, and they're my least favorite parts of the book. But overall, my feeling is that the book, it doesn't purposefully destabilize those binaries or those notions, but it doesn't comfortably inhabit them either.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, having said that, how does this book relate to something like Athena's book?
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they don't exist solely based on, you know, the subjectivity of the author. And I see thematic overlap.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as an extension of my translation practice, they're different.
Jennifer, could you tell us about your two forthcoming projects? You're translating Carl Larson's Form Force and also the Athena Feroxide you were just mentioning, which will be called White Blight. Will you tell us about those books?
I met Carl. He was at the Jon van Eyck Academy, and he asked me to translate it. And so I was not familiar with the book when he asked me, and it was a long project. That's 4 years ago at this point. And it's a four-part book, and the title is Form Force. And it's a more sort of theoretically grounded work that explores questions of political action, political discourse, and sound, and form, and force, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't describe it better than that. He could probably describe it much better. But so there was, the whole time I was translating, there was this theoretical framework that I had to remain loyal to, which was much harder because it wasn't my framework. I hadn't constructed it. And it was something that became apparent to me only very late in the process. Like, I fully understood and inhabited it only pretty recently.
Wow.
Like I said, it's a four-part book. The first part explores the sort of history of the Red Army faction. The second part, and I'm not describing it very accurately, but just to sort of illustrate the heterogeneity of the book, the second part is about Joy Division. The third part is about the Buddhas of Bamiyan in Afghanistan. And the fourth part is about Andy Warhol's film Sleep,
mm-hmm.
and John Giorno, the actor in that. And then the fifth part, which is sort of an appendix in a way, is like footnotes,
mm-hmm.
That sort of fuse all of those four parts.
Mm-hmm.
A, I was never a Joy Division fan. I've only seen, like most people, I've only seen 10 minutes of Sleep. And my engagement with Afghanistan was not about the Buddhas. So I had to like reapproach all of these things.
Right. Would you read an excerpt for us?
What I would like to read is a section about the Buddhas, which is titled Enemy, the Red Shadows in the Valley. So I'll just read a few pages from that. And the interesting thing about this section, it takes up a lot of the questions that you and I have talked about around the role of Sweden internationally, because it challenges the idea of benevolent Sweden acting on the geopolitical arena, because Sweden's actions in Afghanistan in relation to the Buddhas, as represented in this section of the book, is so fucked up. So it starts sort of in the middle. Each section is just like a long poem as well. The stories of the Buddhas in Bamiyan is that sandstone crumbles, entire mountains are worn down to desert. An explosion only hurries the natural process. The desert is our home. Our knowledge of it accumulates, though must always begin again from point zero. It does not accumulate. The stone's state is once again only, quote, a warning from the Ice Age. The sculptor's philosophy has always been subject to the material, and so on. The story of the Buddhas in Bamiyan is that the Taliban's complete isolation, Pakistan's repudiation on October 12, truly created a desperate position in a political and religious breakaway faction, which claimed loyalty to a greater power than North America and Europe. The Northern Alliance hold against Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, the difficulty in controlling the opium plantations, that is to say, get the farmers to cease their deadly day job. God's presence in heroin addiction. Why did the West not support this desire? To truly alter the conditions for hundreds of thousands of drug farmers. Why are stone figures so loaded with the conservator nation's monolithic anxiety? And the story of the Buddhas in Bamiyan is that their faces, which for hundreds of years have been gone, consisted either of mud and straw, painted in bright colors and decorated, or were carved out of wood and were therefore gigantic masks, replaceable and seasonal. Almost no researcher believes that they were carved out of the rock. An earlier generation of revisionists would in that case have carried out a nearly superhuman and meticulous work in their removal. And during the occupation, a Swedish delegation traveled to Bamiyan. Earmarked funds from the government and UN were to be utilized for an extensive renovation of the two Buddhas' faceless faces. Mullah Omar states in an interview, year 2004, I did not want to destroy the Bamiyan Buddha. In fact, some foreigners came to me and said they would like to conduct repair work of the Bamiyan Buddha that had been slightly damaged due to rains. This shocked me. I thought, these callous people have no regard for thousands of living human beings, the Afghans who are dying of hunger, but they are so concerned about non-living objects like the Buddha. This was extremely deplorable. That is why I ordered its destruction. Had they come for humanitarian work, I would never have ordered the Buddha's destruction.
That was Jennifer Hayashida reading her translations of Swedish poet Carl Larsson. Jennifer, could I ask you to read your translations of Athena Farrokhzad? It's another forthcoming project for you this year. And then perhaps we can discuss the two projects together, maybe through the lens of the cultural critic as artist in Sweden.
So I'm going to read the first few pages from White Blight by Athena Farrokhzad. My family arrived here in a Marxist tradition. My mother immediately filled the house with Christmas knickknacks, weighed the pros and cons of the plastic Christmas tree as if it was her problem. During the day, she distinguished between long and short vowels, as if the sounds that came out of her mouth could neutralize the olive oil in her skin. My mother let bleach run through her syntax. On the other side of punctuation, her language became whiter than a winter in Norrland. My mother built us a future consisting of quantity of life. In the suburban basement, she lined up canned goods, as if preparing for a war. In the evenings, she searched for recipes and peeled potatoes, as if it was her history inscribed in the Janson's temptation casserole. To think that I sucked at those breasts, to think that she put her barbarism in my mouth. My mother said, "It seems it has never occurred to you that it is from your name civilization descends." My mother said, "The darkness in my stomach is the only darkness you rule." My mother said, "You are a dreamer born to turn straight eyes aslant." My mother said, "If you could regard the circumstances as extenuating, you would let me off easier." My mother said, "Never underestimate the trouble people will take to formulate truths possible for them to bear." My mother said, "You were not fit to live from the start."
That was Jennifer Hayashida reading from White Blight, her translations of Athena Farrukh Saad. And here's Athena reading from the original Vitsvit.
Min familj anlände hit i en marxistisk idétradition. Min mor fyllde genast huset med prydnadstomtar, vägde plastgranens för- och nackdelar mot varandra som om problemet vore hennes. På dagarna skilde hon mellan långa och korta vokaler, som om ljuden som kom ur hennes mun kunde tvätta olivoljan ur huden. Min mor lät blekmedlet rinna genom syntaxen. På andra sidan skiljetecknet blev hennes stavelser vitare än en norrländsk vinter. Min mor byggde oss en framtid av livskvantitet. I förortsvillans källarförråd radade hon upp konservburkar som inför ett krig. På kvällarna letade hon recept och skalade potatis som om det var hennes historia som fanns chiffrerad i Janssons frestelse. Tänk att jag sög på de brösten. Tänk att hon stoppade sitt barbari i min mun.
Again, that was Athena Farrukh Saad reading from Vitsvit and Jennifer's translation of the book, which is called White Blight, which will be available shortly. So I have a question about the artist as cultural critic, if that role is available to artists in Sweden, if the public takes seriously the thoughts of artists on politics and culture, and especially with the Athena and Carl Larsson in our minds regarding race, ethnicity, and perceptions of Swedish culture and perceptions of international cultures.
It's a huge question.
Sorry.
No. It's a really good question, and it's actually a question that's really pressing right now in Sweden. There's a really active debate around that right now, and just in terms of representation, like who's writing for the major newspapers, who's getting exhibitions, who's being published, and what kind of understanding does or does not exist around questions of, you know, racialization and, you know, because Sweden has such a long history of engaging with class politics, but the public debate around race is still so formative and people don't think that. Sweden still identifies as a sort of anti-racist place, even though it is not.
Mm-hmm.
There's still very much a center and there's still very much a margins in terms of this debate, although now the sort of margins are developing their own center and margins as well. But I think in terms of what's being written, I have a friend who is a journalist in Sweden. You know, she just published a book about this Roma children's book author. Well, she was known as a children's book author, but she wrote novels for adults as well. Her biography is like an intersectional analysis of the welfare state, because the way that this woman was treated and the sort of advocacy, the civil rights advocacy that she had to do, revealed the fissures in the welfare state in terms of how to deal with a racial other, and in particular then how to deal with the Roma people in Sweden and statelessness and questions of like political disenfranchisement and how does the state enfranchise nomadic people, and then questions around gender and language. And I think that there are more and more people like her, but Sweden is still, and Sweden, and by saying Sweden, I'm obviously generalizing tremendously, but there's still, Sweden's still at a sort of multicultural,
like the 90s,
celebratory.
Yeah.
They still inhabit that
yeah.
space pretty
yeah.
actively, and, you know, the debate at the state level
mm-hmm.
is so naive
mm-hmm.
and uninformed that it's kind of embarrassing sometimes to see what people say around questions of migration and what it means to be anti-racist or what it means to be invested in racial justice or social justice. So it's fascinating to me because, you know, on the one hand, I'm in the US and some of the people I talk to in Sweden have sort of idealized notions of what it means to be in the US and to be working in ethnic studies and what social and racial justice looks like in the U.S. Because it's such an explicit discussion
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways, whereas in Sweden, it's like a car that keeps stalling. And so for them, it seems great. But what's so interesting for me is to see how this discussion is going to evolve in Sweden,
mm.
because it has to evolve. Whether it'll evolve or devolve is a whole other question, but...
Mm.
But I think that's what I'm really interested in as a translator as well, is sort of how to do what I can do to internationalize those discussions
mm-hmm.
there so that those poets
mm.
and cultural critics don't have to do that work on their own.
Yeah.
Being in alignment with, you know, folks elsewhere who are doing similar work.
Yeah.
And I think that's my objective in a lot of
yeah.
ways, is to do what I can to facilitate that. But there is that interesting aspect of them, the two sort of spaces being in different times and or in different stages
mm-hmm.
of their sort of evolution around thinking around race and
mm-hmm.
identity. So,
and it seems to me that in choosing to translate contemporaries and in the specific people you've chosen to translate, you're really playing a part of that evolution. You know, it's activist work.
The sort of secret in all that, which is, I guess, a way to sort of return to the beginning of the interview as well, is that, you know, I met with Athena this summer, and I just wrote about this because I got a pen for that translation, and they had me write about why I translated it. And one of the things that became clear to me as I was writing this essay is that Athena's
mm-hmm.
book is a kind of book that would have been so meaningful to me when I was 18.
Yeah.
And when I felt sort of alien to Sweden. And I think there's a way in which, not to psychoanalyze myself too much, but I think there's a way in which doing these translations, and that goes for all of them, where it's a way for me to return to Sweden and Swedishness. And these books in various ways unsettled that notion. But by unsettling it, it seems very familiar to me because I felt so unsettled
mm.
when I lived there. And so it's a way to sort of reach a kind of understanding about myself as well, I think. Because when I met with Athena and we were talking about, you know, her book and how she arrived at the book and how the book was actually made, which is something that I have to discuss with her about how much she wants to talk about that. But it was just so... It was so nice because it was a conversation that I had been dying to have for so long, and I didn't know that I had been missing it until I had it. And so the translation was a way for me to have a conversation that I didn't know that I needed to have.
You've been listening to the Circumference podcast series. I'm your host, Montana Ray, and I'd like to say a huge thank you to Jennifer Hayashida. Jag ska dansa fast den hjärtat brister, ska dansa fast den hjärtat brister. Det går sönder i takt med basen i marken, det går sönder i takt med verkande huvudet, vulkan inuti men polerade ytan, det här golvet ikväll jag stavar sist här. Dansa fast den hjärtat brister, dansa fast du inte är här. We'll be right back.
för att hjärtat blöder. Ska dansa för att hjärtat blöder. Om ett år eller två kommer det här vara över. Om ett år eller två kommer det här vara över. Om ett år eller två kommer det här vara över. Om ett år eller två kommer det här vara över. Om ett år eller två kommer det här vara över. Om ett år eller två är det aldrig över.